25th year of serving the musical, political, and cultural needs of the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world.
For more information, go to kboo.fm/45rpm2013.
Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Portland's only community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing new perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events that dig deeper than the far too uncritical reporting and analyses of the conventional media. Today on our program, Bill Resnick talked with Gudars Ekhtadari. Ekhtadari was for many years the host of the Voices of the Middle East here on KBOO. They'll be discussing the history of the conflict with Iran and the current situation. Next up, Ivan Hale will be sharing some stories about sexual assault in the military. Is a nation state, when it isn't in direct collusion with global capital, capable of protecting us from its worst predations? Guardian columnist George Monbiot reveals a disturbing development in international trade deals in an article entitled A Full Frontal Assault on Democracy in Europe and the United States, which I'll be sharing with you. The contract between Portland Public Schools and the Portland Association of Teachers expired in June. Fran Michel will be here with a report on current contract negotiations. Closing out our program today, Bill Resnick will return to briefly talk with Jen Davis about a KBOO event coming this Thursday at the Clinton Street Theater. It's a film entitled The Yes Men Fix the World. But now here's Bill Resnick discussing U.S. relations with Iran with Gudars Ekhtadari.
Thanks, Tom. Gudars Ekhtadari, welcome to KBOO once again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gudars should be familiar to KBOO listeners. For many years, he hosted the show Voices in the Middle East. During those years, he lived in Portland. He was an engineer for the city of Vancouver, recently left Portland and his show to take a position as an engineer in Abu Dhabi, one of the United Arab Emirates. Gudars' family was from Iran. He grew up in Iran. He came here, became a citizen, continued to study Iran, has written on it, maintained contacts, and he's been active in peace politics in Portland for many years. I'm sure many of you out there have heard him speak. Gudars, give us some background about the U.S.-Iran struggle, particularly its, and then we can get to its current manifestation, which is about nuclear development in Iran, but which really is about the future of the Middle East. But first, give us the background on the U.S. and Iran.
Well, if I want to really give a precise background of the American presence in Iran, I should go about 110 years ago, where some missionaries from American churches arrived in Iran, and they basically brought with them some sense of modernity and the kind of culture that at that time Americans were associated with. And the idea of democracy was actually somehow connected in those days with the American form of government, the American approach to the world issues. And basically, it was a very positive image that Americans held in Iran for quite some time, at least until 1953, when all of a sudden they decided to take part in a military coup against Dr. Mossadegh, who has nationalized the Iranian oil. And even that, in the process of nationalizing the oil, Dr. Mossadegh basically was asking for a sort of deal that American has reached with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And so in kind of opposition to British way of dealing with oil in the Middle East, Iranian Prime Minister was asking and kind of hoping for some sort of support from American president at that time. And I believe it was Harry Truman. But then with the election of Eisenhower, I think the whole hopes that Iran had basically went away. And in a trip that Dr. Mossadegh did to New York, he actually met the American administration and explained the situation in Iran and how Iranians were really asking for a share of the oil production, as opposed to Brits, that they thought and they always said that without us, you don't have any oil. So we are basically, and the situation was kind of ironic. The American the British government tax on oil revenue of the company that at that time used to be called British Petroleum was about 6%, which was not even equal to the Iranian revenue from that same oil that was coming out of Iranian land. So in a way, this ended up with a coup d'etat that Eisenhower took part in, and CIA basically did the whole operation. Later, we were told that it was called Ajax. And basically, that's the story of how all of a sudden the relation and the expectation and image of Americans in Iran went sour. And for the next, I would say, 25 years after that coup, in the grassroots Iranian activists and grassroots Iranian social and civil society, the American image totally changed and became an oppressor, became it was basically associated with military intervention everywhere in the world, the Vietnam War and everything else. So that's not really the history detailed with Iranian relation. But then in 1979, when Iranian basically a civil revolution took place in Iran, and Ayatollah Khomeini became the leader of the revolution after basically only about 6 to 9 months of uprising within the country. Then at that time, Jimmy Carter was president in the U.S., and he actually took a position of not trying to military intervene, and that helped the Iranian revolution to succeed. But after that, obviously, there were other problems, including the hostage crisis of 79-80s. And then Ronald Reagan coming to White House. And during his 8 years, there were still some kind of dealing and dealing between the Iranians and Americans with regards to the Iraq war that was happening. And so, and since the whole military system in Iran was based on American technology and model and equipment, so they had still doing these, what is then, again, we heard of Iran-Contra, which was basically selling arms to Iran in the black market, to help the the anti-revolutionary in Nicaragua.
Right. The of course, in the Iraq-Iran, the war between Iraq and Iran, the U.S. was supplying both sides, that is, Saddam Hussein in Iraq and the Iranian government with weapons. And it was very cynical, it seems to me. Vast numbers of people were killed on both sides. That is, men were killed on both sides. The demographics of both countries have been affected by that ever since. The U.S. really was interested in weakening both of those states, it seems to me, a kind of Kissinger-esque strategy, which unfortunately worked.
That's true. That's true. I mean, at the same time, while they were selling Iranian needed arms through black market, through Saudi Arabia, and through Israel, that's the ironic part of it, is that Israelis at that time were advocating and lobbying through their intermediaries in the U.S. to make sure that U.S. would provide equipment that Iran needed against the Saddam Hussein, because at that time Israelis were more basically afraid of Iraqis' intervention, and so they were basically lobbying for U.S. to provide support to Iranian. But at the same time, as you know, Rumsfeld and others were traveling to Baghdad and providing services and especially information, because they had planned the whole Iranian military setting and locations and everything, and they provided all that information to Iraqi army. So at the same time, yes, you are absolutely right.
And they, in fact, gave poison gas to the Iraqis to use on the Iranians. That's one of the extraordinary things about that war, was the use of poison gas, which was, you know, all the facilities for making it were supplied to Iraq by the U.S.
Yeah, it was U.S. and other Western countries, including Germany and France. They both participated in the chemical.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Gudarz Ekhtadari, who did the show Voices of the Middle East on KBOO for a long time. He's moving to Abu Dhabi to work as an engineer, retains U.S. citizenship, and assures me he'll be back on KBOO some years from now, I hope. Gudarz, let's go to the current period. Israel has now decided that Iran is their great enemy, although they're also worried about Iraq, because the U.S. wars in Iraq have really strengthened Iran and strengthened what they call the Shiite crescent, I guess, in the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, Syria, which is now in flames, and Palestine are the... any event, those forces have been strengthened, and the U.S. and Israel in the lead, in fact, now sort of wagging the tail, wagging the dog. That is, Israel is sort of making U.S. policy to some extent, although Obama's resisting to some extent. There's splits in the United States. We'll get to that. What's happening right now, though, in these explain the Iran, nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and what the current peace talks between the U.S. and other Western powers and Iran, what do they mean?
Well, to begin with, again, I need to explain that the whole Iranian nuclear project, the building of a energy reactor in Iran, goes back to 1967, when Gerald Ford basically convinced the Shah of Iran at that time that Iran needs to invest in nuclear facilities and have the and use the nuclear energy as opposed to oil. At that time, that project was really facing a lot of opposition inside the civil society in Iran, because it didn't make sense. It was an economically sound decision. But after the Islamic Revolution, when Iran, there was a reactor in Bushehr by Persian Gulf under construction at the time of the Islamic Revolution. And Iran decided that, at the beginning, Iran basically canceled the contract with Siemens, a German company who was building the reactor. And after 2 years, they came back and said, we have this thing unfinished, let's finish it. At that time, the Western countries, and specifically United States, did not allow any activity on that site to move forward. And so Iranians, within 3 or 4 years, they found Russians that were able or they were willing to participate in this project and finish the reactor. So that's how the nuclear project in Iran restarted in mid-80s, after 20 years of basically being a project, an American project in Iran. And during this process, they realized that it is almost impossible to find the technology and invest in any aspect of it, including the enrichment of uranium.
And how is
So they thought that this actually, in a sense, also coincided with the Iraq War. So even if they did have a military weaponization of the system, in their mind, it stopped after the Iran-Iraq War, and especially after, in 2003, after invasion of Iraq by George Bush. So since then, this project has been totally a project for enrichment of uranium to use in reactors. The reason for it, for a self-sufficiency in the technology, has been that they thought that it will not be provided by the West, and so they went through a kind of a genuine nationalized project. Now, in the past 10, 12 years, this has become a major obstacle in opening up to the West. The Iranian presidents after the Iraq War, both Hashemi, Rafsanjani, and Mohammad Khatami were trying to open up the channels of communication with the West and try to even encourage investment from Western countries into Iran, which European Union took on that offer in early 2000 and the whole 90s. And they were involved in Iranian development of national industries, car making, and all kind of aspects of the industrialization of the country. So they were basically the only stakeholders in this situation until 2003-04, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, first invaded Afghanistan and then Iraq. And as you explained, Iran became really a more influential in the whole region, an influence that Saudi Arabia and other countries, rich countries in the Persian Gulf, they could not really tolerate and they were not interested in seeing happening. And that's what you mentioned as a Persian Crescent, basically coming from Iran, going through Iraq, Syria, and then Lebanon. It became a major obstacle for Sunni powers in the region, and that's what they have been investing for. And they were basically hoping that U.S. would get involved in Syrian war, especially Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who are basically mostly investing in this their project in Syria, to basically topple the government of Syrian President Bashar Assad, and instate a new, more friendly to Saudi Arabia government there. And when the few months ago, when the negotiation between Lavrov and John Kerry resulted in a solution for the chemical weapons in Syria, Saudi Arabia got totally upset, and because of that, because they were expecting that U.S. would really militarily intervene. And as you mentioned, Obama was not eager to get involved again in another war in the region, and so they basically grabbed the opportunity that Lavrov provided and Putin provided, basically, and went with it. And because of that, obviously, the military intervention in Syria is not encouraged by any means or being accepted by any means. But Saudi Arabia doesn't like it. And from the Western countries, during the negotiation at Security Council, France all of a sudden came in as opposing that agreement between John Kerry and Lavrov. And that conflict between France and the U.S., I don't know if that's just a good cop, bad cop game, or it's genuinely the foreign policy of France dictate this kind of behavior. This past weekend, during the negotiation in Geneva, which was basically hammered out and drafted an agreement between Iran and what is initially called the EU 3 plus 3, which both there were Germany, France, and England from European Union, and then China, Russia, and United States from outside the EU, but now is being called also P5 plus 1, which is five permanent members of Security Council plus Germany. So these negotiations was drafted, an agreement was drafted between John Kerry and Javad Zarif, Iranian foreign minister, and Catherine Ashton, the foreign policy chief of the European Union. But all of a sudden on Saturday, where all the other foreign ministers unexpectedly decided to go to Geneva, and everybody was expecting that there would be a signing ceremony and announcement and big, obviously, show for this. France all of a sudden said that he's not going to tolerate because Israel is not happy with it, and some Arab friends in the region are not happy with it. And from what I know, the reason France is involved so much and so adamantly in trying to derail this agreement comes from expectation that François Hollande, the president of France, even though he is from a socialist party, but he basically, in foreign policy, continues exactly what Sarkozy, the conservative president, did, and that basically bases on some, I guess, economic and financial help from both Israel and Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries such as Qatar for investment in France and also for controlling the influence of Muslim communities in France that are in, basically yeah. growing and increasing by number because of all the, I guess, the imperialist actions of the past that now brings all the North Africans and people from Arabian Peninsula to Europe and specifically to France because of the occupation that French did in Algeria and other countries and Mali right. and everywhere else.
Yeah, the French and the Israelis have, and the Saudis have this interest in isolating Iran and isolating that, although they're really, their interest would be to cooperate with Iran the same way that Iran cooperated with the United States after 9/11. Iran has given every signal now with this new president to, in fact, cooperate in trying to stabilize the Middle East, but that's really a that's opposed by Saudi Arabia, Israel, and apparently now France, which was a great disaster, it seems to me, that we discovered over the weekend. But these negotiations are going to continue. Gudars, thanks a lot for talking. We're going to have to end this one now. Will you be available in Abu Dhabi, though, to talk to us? They're really technologically superior, actually, in that Gulf state. I hope you can talk again. We'll talk about the continuation. These negotiations are going to continue. It's really in the U.S.'s interest to not get involved in further wars in the Middle East for the benefit of the Saudis and the Israelis. And a lot of forces in the United States are resisting that, even though they're not friendly to Iran.
I think it's currently scheduled for November 20th to meet again in Geneva.
Right. So we'll talk again.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me today.
And you're available on this cell phone in Abu Dhabi, I hope?
Well, after the show, give me a call and I will give you my email so we can kind of schedule it by email. Because of time difference, it's difficult to kind of say something right now.
Right. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks so much for talking. Have a good trip back and
Thank you.
I hope work is good there and talk to you soon.
Thank you, Bill.
Right. So long.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Now Ivan Hale is here with some stories and commentary on sexual abuse and assault in the military.
Good morning. It's Veterans Day, the day that government employees get off work, the day Snoopy goes to Bill Malden's house and quaffs a few root beers, the day we as a country have set aside to honor those who have fought and died in the service of this country while fighting members of other countries. Veterans Day started with Armistice Day in 1919 at the end of World War I and was proclaimed by President Woodrow Wilson, who said, quote, "To us in America, the reflections of Armistice Day will be filled with solemn pride in the heroism of those who died in this country's service, and with gratitude for the victory, both because of the thing from which it has freed us, and because of the opportunity it has given America to show her sympathy with peace and justice in the councils of the nations." End quote. Wow. I had to read that quote a few times before it made any sense to me. The wars of 100 years ago are not the wars of today. Not at all. Today's wars aren't. They're conflicts, decades-long conflicts that have no specific enemy and no specific end in sight. The enemy, we are told, is terror. And terror, we are told, looks like a bearded, brown-skinned young man who may or may not have kilos of bombs strapped to him, who may believe that he will go to heaven if he blows himself up and takes a few U.S. soldiers with him. This young man, this ideology we are supposedly fighting against, believes Americans have loose morals, that women have too many freedoms, should be wrapped in shroud, should be hidden from the male gaze so as not to tempt him to sin, should be seen as property and used to bear children and beaten, stoned, raped, or killed if they behave incorrectly. These people, this ideology that would seek to squash our American way of life, is supposedly our enemy. It must then be quite amazing to see our enemy, to see women as soldiers, dressed in battle garb, carrying weapons. It must be equally amazing to the women soldiers who, upon enlistment, find their biggest risk is not being killed by this oppressive enemy, but by being beaten and raped by one of their fellow male soldiers. To simply use the latrine, women are told to take along, quote, a battle buddy, so they will not be attacked. The Pentagon recently reported that sexual assaults are up to 70 per day, which, according to the Washington Post, translate to almost 3 rapes every hour, all day long, all night long, every 24 hours. In my mind, the fact that this is a Pentagon report means that this is probably a conservative estimate. And this is alarming. Rather than use the rest of my time on the air today to regurgitate statistics or cry out about how reprehensible the reality of assault against women is, I thought I would let the women soldiers who have experienced this speak for themselves. The website My Duty to Speak is a site dedicated solely as a forum for women to tell their stories, anonymously or not. The following stories are edited for brevity. I was at Sather Air Force Base, Iraq, in November 2009. This was my third tour in the region. I was having trouble with a coworker, and one night I went to the bathroom. As I came out of the stall, he was standing there and threw me up against the wall and raped me. He left me there, and when I finally left, I went to my commander who told me that it is a he said, she said sort of situation. 12 years of service went down the drain that night. From that point on, the Air Force saw me as damaged goods, and they told me I had PTSD and medically discharged me. Just a year before, I was a rising star doing what I love, and now I spend my days at the VA, taking pills and trying to find a reason to live. Sophie was the oldest of three children. She had always wanted to be a soldier. She scored in the 98th percentile of her Armed Service Vocational Aptitude Battery. She was well on her way to success when she decided to join the United States Army. In 3.5 years, Sophie was raped while she was on duty in White Sands, New Mexico, in Shiran, Afghanistan, and at Fort Stewart, Georgia. The same man raped her in Afghanistan and at Fort Stewart. He stalked her from Afghanistan to Fort Stewart. She could not get away from him. Sophie called her mother from Afghanistan and said, "Mom, send me a K-bar because I cannot go to the bathroom safely. I have more to fear from my own fellow soldiers than any enemy Afghani with a grenade." She was later found in her room dead with a gunshot wound to her head. The Army told her family that she committed suicide. Her family is demanding an explanation. My first deployment was to Athens, Greece when I was 19 years old. As the only female of a 25-man crew, it quickly became clear that I had invaded a very tight fraternity, and my presence was resented. During the first night there, I was told that every time a newbie deploys, they go out for 6 shots of tequila. I decided to go through with the initiation. My plan was to return to my room to sleep off the alcohol. It wasn't uncommon for underage service members to drink while deployed during those days. But the next day, a female officer who had a room next to mine pulled me aside to tell me that she heard men coming back from the bars and knocking on my hotel door throughout the night. I was horrified. The female officer made a report to our command, and an executive order immediately came down that our squadron prohibited all initiation drinking games now that women were flying. From then on, I was totally isolated. Eventually, I was sent on another deployment. I felt I could manage my interactions with people to ensure what happened on my first deployment didn't happen again. So one evening, when I was asked to be by a quiet, married crew member to join him for a drink, I felt it was safe, low-risk opportunity to socialize. The last thing I remember is having one drink with this man. I am confident I was drugged. The following morning, I woke up black, blue, and purple from head to toe. I had severe bruising and swelling between my legs. I was covered with vomit and bodily fluids. The man I had had one drink with was still there. But the bruising and the mess that was made in the night told me there had been more than one visitor to my room. I soaked in a bath to rid myself of the disgustingness that was done to my body. I put on a turtleneck under my flight suit to hide my bruised neck and went to work broken. In closing, let me reiterate again that 70 sexual assaults occur in the military each day. 3 rapes every hour, every day, 24 hours a day. The stories I read here are not just a select few of those women who feel safe enough to speak. Many do not, and many, like Sophie, die. It's Veterans Day. Let's take a moment to remember those who have lost their sense of safety, their trust, their ability to have healthy intimate relationships, their sense of sanity, and indeed their lives in the name of hypocritical American freedoms. If you or anyone you know has experienced sexual trauma in the military or otherwise, you can call the Veterans Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255. The Sexual Assault Resource Center has a 24-hour crisis line, 503-640-5311, or toll-free 1-888-640-5311. Help is out there. You are not alone. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Ivan Hale.
Thank you, Ivan. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. I remember back in the 90s, the question of whether nation-states were becoming increasingly irrelevant was much talked and written about. Under the pressures of global capitalism, political borders were becoming to be seen as not much more than a means of containing and excluding people, that is, prohibiting the free movement of labor. Meanwhile, international capital and finance roamed the world unencumbered. Over the ensuing years, however, the nation-state, when not in a direct collusion with global capital, has come to be seen by many as the only remaining bulwark against the ever-expanding and nefarious role of the so-called global free market. But international corporations and financial institutions continue their assault on the ability of nation-states to regulate their activities. Today I'm going to share with you an article by George Monbiot, a political environmental activist and weekly columnist for Britain's Guardian newspaper. His most recent article is entitled "A Full Frontal Assault on Democracy in Europe and the United States." Remember, when he speaks of the United States and Britain, he is doing so from the British perspective. Remember that referendum, Monbiot begins, about whether we should create a single market with the United States? You know, the one that asks whether corporations should have the power to strike down our laws? No, I don't either. Mind you, I spent 10 minutes looking for my watch the other day before I realized I was wearing it. Forgetting about the referendum is another sign of aging. Because there must have been one, mustn't there? After all that agonizing over whether or not we should stay in the European Union, the government wouldn't cede our sovereignty to some shadowy, undemocratic body without consulting us, would it? The purpose of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership is to remove the regulatory differences between the U.S. and European nations, the most important issue of which is the remarkable ability it would grant big business to sue the living daylights out of governments which try to defend their citizens. It would allow a secretive panel of corporate lawyers to overrule the will of Parliament and destroy our legal protections. Yet the defenders of our sovereignty say nothing. The mechanism through which this is achieved is known as investor-state dispute settlement. It's already being used in many parts of the world to kill regulations protecting people and the living planet. The Australian government, after massive debates in and out of Parliament, decided that cigarettes should be sold in plain packets marked only with shocking health warnings. The decision was validated by the Australian Supreme Court. But using a trade agreement Australia struck with Hong Kong, the tobacco company Philip Morris has asked an offshore tribunal to award it a vast sum in compensation for the loss of what it calls its intellectual property. During its financial crisis and in response to public anger over rocketing charges, Argentina imposed a freeze on people's energy and water bills. It was sued by the international utility companies whose vast bills had prompted the government to act. For this and other such crimes, it has been forced to pay out over $1 billion in compensation. In El Salvador, local communities managed at great cost, three campaigners were murdered, to persuade the government to refuse permission for a vast gold mine which threatened to contaminate their water supplies. A victory for democracy? Not for long, perhaps. The Canadian company which sought to dig the mine is now suing El Salvador for $315 million for the loss of its anticipated future profits. In Canada, the courts revoked two patents owned by American Drugs from Eli Lilly on the grounds that the company had not produced enough evidence that they had the beneficial effects it claimed. Eli Lilly is now suing the Canadian government for $500 million and demanding that Canada's patent laws be changed. These companies, along with hundreds of others, are suing the investor-state dispute rules embedded in trade treaties signed by the countries they are suing. The rules are enforced by panels which have none of the safeguards we expect in our own courts. The hearings are held in secret. The judges are corporate lawyers, many of whom work for companies of the kind whose cases they hear. Citizens and communities affected by their decisions have no legal standing. There is no right of appeal on the merits of the case, yet they can overthrow the sovereignty of parliaments and the rulings of supreme courts. You don't believe it? Here's what one of the judges on these tribunals says about his work. When I wake up at night and think about arbitration, it never ceases to amaze me that sovereign states have agreed to investment arbitration at all. Three private individuals are entrusted with the power to review, without any restriction or appeal procedure, all actions of the government, all decisions of the courts, and all laws and regulations emanating from the parliament. End quote. There are no corresponding rights for citizens. We can't use these tribunals to demand better protections from corporate greed. As the Democracy Center says, this is a privatized justice system for global corporations. Even if these suits don't succeed, they can exert a powerful chilling effect on legislation. One Canadian government official, speaking about the rules introduced by the North American Free Trade Agreement, remarked that, "I've seen letters from the New York and D.C. law firms coming up to the Canadian government on virtually every new environmental regulation and proposition in the last 5 years. They involve dry cleaning chemicals, pharmaceuticals, pesticides, patent law. Virtually all of the new initiatives were targeted, and most of them never saw the light of day. Democracy as a meaningful proposition is impossible under these circumstances." End quote. This is a system to which we will be subject if the transatlantic treaty goes ahead. The U.S. and European Commission, both of which are captured by corporations they are supposed to regulate, are pressing for investor-state dispute resolution to be included in the agreement. The Commission justifies this policy by claiming that domestic courts don't offer corporations sufficient protection because they might be biased or lack independence. Which courts is it talking about? Those of the U.S., its own member states? It doesn't say. In fact, it fails to produce a single concrete example demonstrating the need for a new extrajudicial system. It is precisely because our courts are generally not biased or lacking independence that the corporations want to bypass them. Well, remember here he's speaking of British courts. The EC seeks to replace open, accountable sovereign courts with a closed, corrupt system riddled with conflicts of interest and arbitrary powers. Investor state rules should be used to smash any attempt to regulate the banks, to curb the greed of energy companies, to leave fossil fuels in the ground. These rules shut down democratic alternatives. They outlaw left-wing politics. This is why there has been no attempt by the UK government to inform us about this monstrous assault on democracy, let alone consult us. This is why the Conservatives who huff and puff about sovereignty are silent. Wake up, people. We're being shafted. We're in the dark about a treaty that would let rapacious companies subvert our laws, rights, and national sovereignty. That was an article that appeared recently in The Guardian by George Monbiot entitled "A Full Frontal Assault on Democracy in Europe and the United States." Monbiot was the author of many books, including Captive State, The Corporate Takeover of Britain. This is the Omaha Rad Hour on KBU 90.7 FM. Now, Fran Michelle reports on an ongoing negotiations between Portland Public Schools and the Portland Association of Teachers for a new contract.
Portland Public Schools, or PPS, and the Portland Association of Teachers, or PAT, the district's biggest union, are in the middle of mediation for their contract, which expired in June. As Nicole Bomer and Jamie Partridge report in Socialist Worker, teachers report that in the first round of mediated negotiations, the union brought multiple proposals, but the district offered none. Teachers have made it clear from the beginning of the bargaining process that their priority is not salary. Teachers are prioritizing small class sizes, the overuse of standardized testing, and time during the workday to prepare for students, personalize instruction, and meet with parents. Last month, teachers, parents, students, and community supporters rallied at the Portland Public Schools headquarters and attended the board meeting. Diana Collins, a teacher at George Middle School, spoke at the school board meeting and said, quote, "During the day, I have a 45-minute planning period to do what I do. That's roughly 6 minutes per period to plan for my 7 classes. This doesn't even include the parent phone calling, emails, organizing our classroom, field trip preparations, learning computer software systems, grading, communicating with our counselors, setting up for science labs, reviewing and meeting individual education program goals. My story is not exceptional. Listen to your teachers about workload, class size, and planning. It's vital to the success of our students and schools." End quote. The district's proposal not only ignores the realities faced by teachers, it also ignores the realities faced by students, and would, in fact, only exacerbate the worst situations by lifting restrictions on teacher workload. Erica Schneider, a teacher with 32 third graders in her classroom, said, quote, "In 11 years, I've worked with more children than I can count who have one parent in prison, more children than I can count who come from one-parent households, more children than I can count who are being raised by grandparents. I have made more calls to DHS to report abuse and neglect than I can count. I work through my half-hour lunch every day, preparing materials for the afternoon. I take curriculum and papers to grade home with me every night to finish after I put my own children to bed. During the school day, there just is not enough time for me to check in with every student. It just isn't right for an 8-year-old to share one adult with 31 other students. So when teachers talk about our workload, it's because our students suffer when their teachers are overworked." Students and parents also spoke at the rally, challenging PPS's message that their proposals aren't about union busting, and revealing that, in fact, it's an attack on our unions and our schools. The district's priorities are plain in other ways beyond the contract proposals. PPS has been paying a private consultant $15,000 per month to direct negotiations with PAT. Additionally, it signed an $800,000 contract with an outside law firm for bargaining advice. As PAT President Gwen Sullivan said at the rally, "The district is spending nearly $1 million on private consultants and labor attorneys instead of putting that toward direct services for our kids. We should all be outraged." As if this wasn't enough reason to be outraged, one parent's testimony at the school board meeting provided more evidence to fuel the movement against the district's push to use standardized testing as the basis for performance and achievement. Paul Anthony, who's had children at Beach Elementary School for more than a decade, explained that one of the main problems is the recent obsession with Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills, or OAKS, test scores. Beach has been using OAKS test scores to publicly rank children, he said. Achievement on the test we used to filter out not just who would walk across the stage at my daughter's 8th grade graduation last year, but even who was mentioned by name. Graduating students not perceived as achieving were left anonymous even as they were promoted. Similarly, as test results are received, children's names are recited to their classes in order of results. All the students know who has the highest score, who the lowest, and where individuals are along the spectrum. Many of my children's classmates are exhibiting signs of extreme stress around testing and receiving their results, including openly weeping and hiding, complaining of headaches and nausea, and becoming increasingly fearful of school altogether. Anthony's testimony provoked gasps from many in the room, horrified by the harm that overuse of standardized testing has caused. These stories from teachers, students, and parents aren't new information to the district. Despite these ongoing systemic issues, PPS continues to claim that the conflict with the union is about pay and that it has to use an aggressive strategy with the teachers' union. The October rally was just one important step in the struggle. The success of PAT rests in the power of the community coming together. The district hopes to silence the voices of parents, teachers, and students in the struggle for quality public schools. PAT is countering this by trying to amplify those voices. This fight is more than just a clash over a contract. It's about building a movement to demand the schools our students deserve. As many observers have noted, most recently David Sirota in Salon, we need a war on poverty, not on teachers. Sirota points out some of the ways that we already know that the dominant storyline about education is baseless propaganda. We know that American public school students from wealthy districts generate some of the best test scores in the world. This proves the education system's problems are not universal. The crisis is isolated primarily in the parts of the system that operate in high poverty areas. It also proves that while the structure of the traditional public school system is hardly perfect, it's not the big problem in America's K-12 education system. If it was the problem, then traditional public schools in rich neighborhoods would not perform as well as they do. Similarly, we know that many of the high-performing public schools in America's wealthy locales are unionized. We also know that one of the best school systems in the world, Finland's, is fully unionized. These facts prove that teachers' unions are not the root cause of the education problem. After all, if unions were the problem, then unionized public schools in wealthy areas and Finland would be failing. So what is the problem? That brings us to a new study from the Southern Education Foundation. Cross-referencing education data, researchers found that a majority of all public school students in one-third of America's states now come from low-income families. How much does this have to do with educational outcomes? A lot. Social science research over the last few decades has shown that two-thirds of student achievement is a product of out-of-school factors, and among the most powerful of those is economic status. That's hardly shocking. Kids who experience destitution and all the problems that come with it have enough trouble just surviving, much less succeeding in school. All of this leads to an obvious conclusion. If America were serious about fixing the troubled parts of its education system, then we would be having a fundamentally different conversation. We wouldn't be talking about budget austerity. We would be talking about raising public revenues to fund special tutoring, childcare, basic health programs, and other so-called wraparound services at low-income schools. More broadly, we wouldn't be discussing cuts to social safety net programs. We would instead be working to expand those programs, and further, to challenge both parties' anti-tax, anti-regulation, pro-austerity agenda that has increased poverty and economic inequality. In short, if we were serious about education, then our education discussion wouldn't be focused on demonizing teachers and coming up with radical schemes to undermine traditional public schools. It would instead be focused on mounting a new war on poverty, and thus directly addressing the biggest education problem of all. For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
And this is The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This coming Thursday, there will be a KBOO event at the Clinton Street Theater. It is a film entitled The Yes Men Fix the World. Here are Bill Resnick and Jen Davis to fill you in on the details.
Thanks, Tom. Jen Davis, welcome to KBOO. You're our interviewee.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jen Davis is a new KBOO board member, now chair of the Development Committee. She has a couple of really interesting friends. Jen, tell us about the Yes Men, your friendship with them, their second film. It's the film we're inviting people to come down to see this Thursday evening, The Yes Men Fix the World. But tell us about first your friendship with them.
Well, I've known Mike Bonanno of the Yes Men for about 30 years. People may not realize, but he has deep roots in Portland. He attended Reed College. And some of the hijinks early on before he became an official Yes Man was being involved with the Reverse Peristalsis Theater.
Oh, he was. I remember them.
People may remember that. That was back in the Bush Quail days when Quail came to Portland in a big limo to speak at the Hilton. A bunch of Reverse Peristalsis painters went on top of the building and ate a bunch of mashed potatoes, some that were painted that had blue food coloring, some had red food coloring, and some were just plain. And then when they drank syrup of Ipecac, which makes you want to throw up. And when Quail arrived, they
I know they did.
They painted the asphalt with their red, white, and blue mask.
In Technicolor, it sure was revolting.
Revolting. So that was an early idea.
I didn't know that.
Yes, and you may remember back. This was in the late '80s. There was a big hubbub over changing the street to Martin Luther King Avenue. You might remember there was this huge, it used to be Union Avenue, and people wanted to change it to Martin Luther King, and a lot of people were against it. So to sort of make a commentary on some of the racist attitudes about that, Mike Bonanno and some others were involved in changing Water Avenue downtown to Malcolm X Boulevard. I don't know if people remember that, but they perfectly replicated the signs all along the whole Water Avenue, and they changed it into Malcolm X Boulevard, and got up in the middle of the night and with cherry pickers and changed all of the signs.
Oh, really? You know, I remember that struggle. One of the pornography shops on King led the fight to keep it as whatever it was, Grand Avenue.
I think it was Union. I can't remember.
Yeah, Union. Mm-hmm. In any event, that was their base of support. it is now, of course, King. Tell us about the Yes Men and well, Mike's new career.
Well, for those who are not familiar with the Yes Men, what they do is they impersonate top officials in large corporations and they are or governmental bodies, and they go into conferences and other events around the world and sort of expose the true dynamics and intentions of these corporations. One of the most famous ones was when they impersonated the WTO. One of my favorite things that they did was they went to a conference, I believe it was in Switzerland, and they said, Andy Bickelbauer, who is Mike Bonanno's partner in the Yes Men, claimed that the WTO had decided that all of their policies were actually destroying poor people, not helping them, even though when you walk into the lobby of the WTO building, it says, you know, our dream is to eradicate poverty.
Jen, and we only have another 30 seconds. We've got to tell people about what's happening Thursday night.
Well, Thursday night at the Clinton Street Theater, November 14th, 7 p.m., Yes Men Fix the World. You can learn all about the hijinks of the Yes Men, which are pretty hilarious and moving. And I really invite people to come out.
Yeah, it's a very funny and also penetrating movie. And if you go down to the theater, you can meet Jen and people in the development committee and people at KBOO. And you can learn a lot about KBOO and become a volunteer and work here and learn radio and become part of this independent station that provides the best radio in the world. So that's Thursday night at what time, Jen?
It's at 7 p.m.
At the Clinton Theater at 26th and Clinton.
Yes.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. This program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about the guests and topics, as well as past programs. Just go to our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And this is KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up next, Eric Astadia is off today. Instead, we'll hear an excerpt from Peace Talks Radio, a series of peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. At 10:15, Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is independent journalist and climate activist Ven Stephenson. We'll talk about environmental justice and the fight against tar sands oil extraction and the Keystone Pipeline.
FM Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present The Yes Men Fix the World. Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO will be showing the 2009 indie classic film The Yes Men Fix the World. The Yes Men Fix the World is the true story of two political activists posing as executives of giant corporations. In their thrift store suits, they lie their way into big business conferences and pull off pranks. That's The Yes Men Fix the World, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm/yesmen2013.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, your community radio station, democratically owned and operated. Coming up next, Air Cascadia is off. Instead, we'll be hearing an excerpt from Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. And after that, Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein.
In the shadow of the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, the radio and online series Peace Talks Radio was begun to preserve a bit of the media landscape for talk about peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution strategies. The goal of the program has been to explore how we can reduce conflict, both inside ourselves and between each other, as well as tell the stories of peacemakers throughout history, the famous and the less well-known, to shine a light on the enormous variety of peace work that is going on in our world. This edition of Peace Talks Radio presents more engaging moments featuring our guests of the first 10 years of the program, 2002 to 2012. If you'd lost a loved one in the terrorist attacks of 2001, how would you have responded? We found that some victims' family members channeled their grief into work for peace by joining a group called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Among the group members we spoke to in 2007 was Ann Muldery, whose son Stephen was trapped in a conference room in one of the twin towers of the World Trade Center and died that day.
As far as enemies and who we view as the cause of our troubles, I'll tell this little story because it was one of the first instances of my being brave enough to speak my mind after my son's death. And I spoke my mind to a truly treasured person who came to me and said, "What they have done to your son is so terrible, and I know they are in hell." And I love this